WSER 107.3. This is Start Making Sense. I am Miles Herbert.
And I am Shane Anderson. This is a show about internet culture, power and politics, social media, Facebook a lot, and really anything that comes up in our feeds this week. We are proudly community radio, and we also record this from home, which is why you might be able to hear some beautiful songbirds in the background.
And the show is recorded on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, whose sovereignty was never ceded. Okay, Shane, so a lot to get through this week. A lot has happened. What's going on?
Yeah, so later in the show, I'll be having a chat to Ariel Bogle, the ABC Science Technology reporter, about her new series, Click Sick, looking at misinformation in Australia.
It just confuses, I suppose, people's perspective. And it can be quite hard for all kinds of people, for everyone, me included, to wade through, I suppose, all this noise.
But first, I actually have a non-Facebook-related story.
Nice.
So this week, a hacker called Alex Hope published a pretty incredible blog post, I guess, about his journey to hack former Prime Minister Tony Abbott's passport number and phone number.
What happened?
So earlier this year, Tony Abbott posted his Qantas boarding pass on Instagram because even former prime ministers aren't immune to posting banal pics about their life on the platform. Alex then took the boarding pass number and used the Qantas Manage My Booking feature to basically get full access to the details of that particular flight.
I guess with hindsight, that seems like not a very smart thing to do, but I imagine a lot of people post photos of their boarding pass on social media.
Yeah, totally. And even when you use the Manage My Booking feature, it usually doesn't pop up with anything more sinister than the flight that you took and the seat you might have been sitting in and maybe whether or not you're a vegetarian. But Alex then took a closer look at the HTML code of that page, which he explains on his blog is one of the Google Chrome features. And he found within this HTML code a ton of personal info about Abbott. Now, he actually discovered this earlier in the year, like much earlier, like in March. The reason it took so long to publish was that he literally spent about 4 months trying to report the issue to Qantas and the government. You should definitely read this post. It is such a wild ride. And we'll put a link on our page, tocr.com/startmakingsense. It's a really funny story, and I don't want to give too much away, but it does end with a phone call between this hacker and Tony Abbott, who then proceeds to complain to him about Microsoft Teams.
Yeah, it sounds like he kind of did this for altruistic reasons, and the story, more than anything, goes to show you should just be a little more careful about the information you put out there.
Especially if you're a former prime minister.
This is Start Making Sense on 2SER 107.3. Shane, you've been on the phone this week?
Yeah, so this week I had a chat to Ariel Bogle.
My name's Ariel Bogle, and I am a technology reporter with the ABC Science Unit.
She's just put out a short radio series with the show Science Friction. It's called Click Sick, and it looks really closely at the effects of misinformation in Australia. I mean, this year in particular, the infodemic has just spun out in a lot of crazy ways, and I think we have a tendency to look at how insane things are in other places of the world and feel like there's almost a distance between ourselves and all the kind of quote-unquote online issues like misinformation. So it's really cool that this series takes a closer look at the impacts of misinformation at home and talking to the people that it's directly affected. Why did you decide to focus on health misinformation for this?
I've been covering health misinformation quite intently since the pandemic began. I think it was back in January and February when we first started to see strange content, I suppose, circulating on social media. This was content that was kind of speculative or conspiratorial about the origins of the virus. So, you know, these claims that people probably have come across that the coronavirus is somehow a bioweapon created by, you know, China, the United States, Russia, whatever else. So at the beginning, you know, it was really those big picture conspiracies that we see, you know, all the time during big moments of social upheaval. But then I started to notice, I think, as the weeks and months went by, that there was a lot of information circulating out there that, you know, at first glance seemed more minor. It was people being like, you know, standing in the sunlight can help prevent coronavirus, or I recommend you pour boiling water over your fruit and vegetables because the virus is like, can exist on these kinds of surfaces. And this is kind of the content that was circulating in more intimate social spaces like WhatsApp groups or Facebook Messenger. And I think in some ways that can be just as serious because it can have real impacts on people's behavior. They might not take the virus seriously, or they might you know, follow the wrong approach to keeping themselves or their families safe. So that's what this series kind of sets out to examine, at least in the first episode, is those really deeply personal impacts that social media health misinformation can have. And then we go bigger picture, I suppose, in later episodes. The second episode looks more at how nation states can become involved in spreading health misinformation too, and what purpose that serves.
One thing that I found really interesting about the first episode of the series is that you chose to look at the people that are whose personal lives are impacted by misinformation, like the people who fall down the rabbit hole, and also their family and friends who are concerned about them. Did you find that there was like a type of person or a demographic that's most vulnerable to misinformation?
Well, it's a good question. I think people would like an easy answer to this, you know, oh, it's only teenagers that fall for misinformation, or it's only older people. But I really don't think that's the case. Actually, throughout this pandemic, we've had a way that people can submit the misinformation they're seeing online to the ABC. And we've had hundreds of submissions, and each time people might write like a little explanation of where they got it. You know, my sister-in-law is sharing this on Facebook, or my son's sharing this. And in that first episode, we look at misinformation that was passed on by somebody's son, and then one that was sort of received by somebody's father, so an older gentleman. So I think, you know, anyone can be caught, I suppose, by misinformation, and for a variety of ways. We can all get caught up in this. I mean, I've certainly been known to, I don't know, take my fair share of natural remedies in the past just because somebody appealing and attractive told me to.
One of the pieces of misinformation is standing in the sunlight of this idea that vitamin D might have some impact on COVID. That seems such a world away from some of the huge issues like election interference, for example. Why is something like the vitamin D piece of misinformation a threat?
Well, I guess at first glance it can seem minor, but it wasn't minor in the lives of the people that lived through it. In our episode, Shahari Ramadas is a gentleman who got in touch with us, and his father was the one that watched this video and started standing in the sun essentially to, you know, protect himself, he thought, from coronavirus. And I should note too that we're still understanding the impact that, you know, things like vitamin D might have on the virus, but there's certainly not firm evidence now to suggest that, you know, standing in the sun will prevent coronavirus in any way. But that aside, you know, it has that impact in a personal way. But we can also look at the bigger picture here. So what happened? A YouTube video was shared by a YouTube platform called Karma News, which is a news outlet based in the language Malayalam, which is a language spoken largely in southwest India. There's a gentleman who's expressing this view that the sun can help in this way. And I guess it just shows the way that these ideas can be broadcast potentially without sufficient scrutiny and find a huge audience. You know, tens of thousands of people watch this video. And that's just one example of many. I mean, throughout this pandemic, we've seen all kinds of people set themselves up as the expert. And I guess the problem is long term, we need to understand whether this is affecting people's behaviour. You know, if you do believe that vitamin D and the sun can prevent COVID-19 after watching such a video, will you then change your behaviour? Will you not wear a mask, or will you not wash your hands, or will you not socially distance and all those things that health authorities tell us to do? So does that sort of spiral out and have impact on our behaviour? I mean, these are the questions we need to answer.
Yeah, have we seen any short-term impacts on behaviour?
It's a good question. I mean, I think we're still yet to understand the full impact of these kinds of online trends during the pandemic. It's something that will require quite careful scrutiny and study. But I think we can say for certain that it is just confusing people, which might be problem enough. You know, I've seen tens of thousands of questions pour into the ABC, people wanting to know how to act, what to do during this pandemic, you know, based on confusing content that they've seen online. You know, it just confuses, I suppose, people's perspective. And it can be quite hard for all kinds of people, for everyone, me included, to wade through, I suppose, all this noise.
Yeah. Among the people that you've been speaking to, what have, say, like concerned relatives and friends, what actions have they taken?
This is a really hard one. I think most people will have an experience of trying to, you know, argue with someone essentially on social media. It's doesn't always turn out so well. I think it's interesting. I've spoken to a few people that work in cognitive science and who have looked at, I guess, the conspiratorial mindset when people are really taking that next step and wading into territory of conspiracy, say, about where the virus came from, that it's a weapon of some sort, or these kinds of baseless ideas. And, you know, you need to assess, I suppose, how far down the rabbit hole they are. If they're all the way down, it can be really hard to reach them and pull them back up. But I think certainly confrontation and anger will not be a useful way to approach it. I mean, by all accounts, empathy, sort of relying on your shared values, and even sharing skepticism, because, you know, being skeptical of the official account or being skeptical of what you read, see, and hear is like not a bad quality at all. So we want to differentiate that from, you know, conspiracy theories. It is good to be skeptical, but if you can share with that person that you too value skepticism, but we need to look at good evidence and you know, get to the bottom of things in that way, that can be helpful. The other idea, I suppose, too, is it's not just about the person that believes in conspiracies or believes that sun is going to protect them from COVID-19. It's also the people around them, because, of course, on social media, that gives you the tool to share or broadcast your point of view. So we need to think, too, about inoculating the people that might see this content so they aren't drawn into this, too.
I love that you use the word inoculating when a lot of this does have to do with things like anti-vaccination movements.
Definitely. And I should say this sort of like idea of inoculating the public against misleading information or conspiracy theories, it's one that's been discussed by a lot of theorists, John Cook, who's a cognitive scientist, Stephen Lewandowski and others. But yeah, for sure, these kinds of tropes of question the facts or look deeper, they have been co-opted by various groups, including anti-vaccination groups. And I think what struck me a lot reporting on this over the past few months is that everyone thinks they're the most scientific. So even in anti-vaccination groups, it's all about the evidence. And so when you question them or, you know, ask for a comment on a story you're writing, they will often send you just reams of documentation of what they claim is the evidence. It's usually sort of different studies that suit their point of view, sort of collated together without context. But yeah, it's interesting. I think the internet has been both, you know, been an amazing source of information, but it's also allowed information to kind of get all mixed up, and it's hard to judge what is a good source and what's not. And that's particularly true when it comes to scientific data.
raised in the episode was that a lot of this misinformation sits in a pretty grey area legally. One person tried to make a complaint to the police about a video online.
Yeah, that's right. But he tried to report the video that claimed sunlight would prevent in some way COVID-19 with no luck because according to the police he spoke to, it wasn't clear a crime was committed. And I guess in general, there's not much crime in speaking your mind, your point of view on health. Certainly platforms like Facebook and YouTube do have policies around this type of content though, and they've been a little more strict than you might say they have been in the past around this during the pandemic. So quite aggressive in removing content that they consider could cause harm, physical harm. So, you know, there's a lot of content out there telling people to take certain kinds of supplements. I mean, even at worst, there was some content recommending people drink bleach to prevent COVID, and that kind of content should and is often removed by those platforms. But yeah, when it comes to the legal side, it's a bit of a mess, and I guess I would be wary too of criminalizing speech in that way because I don't want to use the term slippery slope, but I think we need to acknowledge that it's a pretty messy space, and starting to police or criminalize certain types of speech could lead us down a pretty dangerous path.
Yeah. I mean, what has reporting on misinformation this year taught you, I guess, about these responses from platforms about things like taking down content or even just like putting labels on content? Are these effective strategies?
Yeah, it's so hard to say. And I want to say too that, you know, these platforms certainly aren't getting it 100% right. So after our first episode, we reported two of the videos that were not in English, but in Malayalam, which is that language spoken in Kerala and southwestern India. And they were removed after we reported them to Facebook and YouTube respectively. But we did talk to some experts on this topic, and as bad as the issue is in English, it's just multiple times worse in other languages because these platforms, of course, are American companies. They were set up in English, and despite their sort of global nature and having teams in various countries all around the world, they do remain somewhat Western-centric and somewhat, you know, Western language-centric too. So their ability to moderate their platforms in other languages is limited. So that's one issue, I think. What I've seen too during this pandemic and in reporting this series is that this push towards more closed and private spaces is risky. So Facebook a few years ago now decided that Facebook groups would be a great way for its platform to function. So it really started promoting and pushing this idea of creating groups around interests. So, you know, you could have a group for dog groomers or you could have a group for your neighbourhood. But because these spaces can be really closed off, they're hard to moderate. And this is really where a lot of the quite extreme content has been fomented. So in these anti-vaccination groups, anti-lockdown groups, you know, other conspiratorial groups is where some of the worst content around the pandemic has begun or at least has spread most effectively.
And there is this huge question of responsibility over a lot of the impacts of this. One thing that we did see in the news this week was a whistleblower who spoke out about Facebook being, I guess, unwilling to engage with some of the direct consequences of being the biggest social media platform in the world.
Sarah, a BuzzFeed article revealing a fired Facebook data scientist wrote a whistleblower memo saying Facebook ignored global political manipulation. This 6,600-word memo gives examples of heads of government and political parties in Honduras, Azerbaijan, and other countries using fake accounts or misrepresenting themselves to influence public opinion.
Where does the buck stop with things like this?
If I had the answer to that, I probably wouldn't be here.
You'd have a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, potentially. Obviously, the platforms have to wear a great deal of the responsibility. They make money because we're on their platforms and we live there, we share there, we chat there. And so, obviously, they bear a great deal of responsibility about what is allowed to sort of breed on their platform and amplify. But I think it's important, you know, YouTube and Facebook didn't invent conspiracy theories. They didn't invent misinformation. I mean, certainly the platforms allow these that type of content to spread further and faster than ever before. And I do think platforms like Facebook and YouTube, because of the way they work, like as recommendation engines and the way those groups sort of intertwine, they have allowed people that would never have been exposed to certain ideas to potentially be exposed to them now. But at the same time, I think I would advocate kind of looking deeper, because as I mentioned, I think people are receptive to conspiracy theories some of the time because they're scared and, you know, feeling vulnerable, which we all are probably during this pandemic. But we need to look at the social fault lines that these kinds of conspiracies can exploit and ask if we can offer people a better vision of the world. I mean, if we offered something better, maybe people wouldn't be so attracted by ideas of evil forces or cabals at play. So, you know, it's a messy answer, I know, but I think we need to look at everything at once.
No, that's great. And it's probably a really good note to end on. What's next for the series? What are you tackling next?
Sure. So in episode one, we really looked at that personal impact of health misinformation. And in episode two, we're looking at that interplay between how nation states exploit health misinformation and health conspiracies and how societies receive them. And then in the third and final episode, we're going to look at the world of wellness. So I'm sure people are well aware there's a whole world of Instagram and YouTube wellness influencers who will tell you how to eat, sleep, exercise, and all the rest. But it has been interesting during this pandemic to see some of these influencers sort of delving into the world of conspiracy theories and becoming more extreme in their views or the views that they promote. So we're going to be looking at that journey, the history of wellness, and how it's ended up there.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
No worries.
That was Ariel Bogle, ABC. That was Ariel Bogle, technology reporter with ABC Science, talking about her three-part series, Click Sick, which is airing in the Science Friction feed. Search for Science Friction to have a listen to that podcast online.
And that's it for the show today. Thank you guys once again for listening. It means a lot. It's good hanging out with you guys on Saturday morning.
We will be back next week with a brand new episode. In the meantime, we have a website. It's 2ser.com/startmakingsense. And there you can listen to past episodes and interviews that we've done. And also we'll put some links up as well to ClickSick and to Alex Hope's amazing tale of hacking Tony Abbott.
Stick around for some really amazing music programming throughout the day. Coming up just now is Contact.
I am Shane Anderson.
And I've been Miles Herbert.
Thank you so much for listening.
Cheers. You've got to get me out. I've been living so pure under your care.
I'm on a